Well, many years ago, back in the mid-80s, a long time ago, I served as a pastor of a small congregation in Decatur, Indiana. I was in my mid-30s at the time, if you can imagine something like that. And this was back in the days when it was common for churches to publish a monthly newsletter for its members. This would not be an online newsletter because there'd be no such thing at that time, but a real newsletter made of real paper. And our church did this as well. In fact, I still have some of those issues that we printed. And so I would go around and I would ask certain members to contribute articles, stories, testimonies, that sort of thing. And one member even drew up cartoons for us. On one of the monthly issues, a member named Tom wrote a poem for me to use. Generally, I'm not that much into poems, but this one was quite remarkable. It was very vivid, colorful, powerful in describing the story of Christ's birth, ministry, death, resurrection, and coming kingdom. It was kind of long, many verses. It was divided up into a number of sections, maybe six or eight, something like that. Each was kind of a poem in itself, and I included it. The newsletter was published, and things went on as usual. Several months later, during a communion service, Tom came up to me seeking forgiveness. He had been holding a deep grudge against me, and the Lord was dealing with him about it and wanted to confess that to me. And obviously, I was eager to learn what I had done to offend him. After all, this was the only person I had ever offended, and so I was quite curious about the whole thing. He was upset because I had taken liberty to edit his poem. The gist of his complaint went something like this. Believing that I did not like the last two sections, I simply deleted them. The least I could have done was to talk to him about it first, but typical of the way I do things, I gave no thought to the feelings of others, exerted my own way, and plowed ahead, deleting those parts that I thought were stupid, confusing, unhelpful, or whatever. And so he, as you can see, had been harboring some deep resentment over this and again asked that I would forgive him. Now, I had no idea that he was upset with me, but more to the point, I had no idea what he was talking about. I assured him that I had done no such thing, but the facts were the facts. The version in the newsletter was incomplete. Now, fortunately for me, because I have a habit of saving everything, I still had the original copy that he submitted. And as it turned out, the sections that didn't make it in the publication were on the back side of the page. The poem was written in such a way that the last verse of the first page sounded like a conclusion, and I simply failed to turn the page over. And so, yes, part of the poem was eliminated, but no, it was not intentional. It was somewhat of a fluke. Truly an innocent mistake. I was quite relieved to have discovered the problem, and after showing everything to him, he was greatly relieved as well. And from that point on, I always look on the backside of anything that anyone gives me. But that, of course, is not the lesson for this morning, to look on the backside of things. It's not even the importance of talking to someone who has wronged us, giving them a chance to explain instead of letting resentment set in, although that would be a worthwhile sermon. Nor is my message today about forgiveness. There is another lesson here in this incident. The whole thing raises an important question. Why would Tom be so quick to assume that I would intentionally edit what he gave me? If he thought that there had been some mistake or oversight, he would have said something right away when the newsletter was sent out. The fact that it took months before he brought it up to me shows that he immediately thought the worst, that I had ill will. Why would this be the case? In fact, I had never revised or changed or tried to improve anything he ever gave me for these newsletters or anything anyone gave me for these newsletters. I had no history of this. And Tom was not the sort of guy who assumed the worst in others. So what was going on here? Well, the thing is, there was a history. There was a history of sorts. Maybe not with the monthly newsletters, but it was not unlike me in other areas to take liberties. I would occasionally correct what other people did and try to improve it and plow ahead with my own way because, well, my way is the better way and no one else could do it as good as I could. And at the time, I had no idea, really, that this was true of me. But this mindset, this attitude, was quite obvious to everyone else. It was only a matter of time before I would edit someone's poem. In the interest of achieving the greater good, I could be quite oblivious to other people's feelings. And again, I was blind to this, but as I eventually discovered, this was my reputation. And to some degree, unfortunately, it still is. This incident serves as a good example of what I want to address today: fallout from our reputations. Each of us, every one of us here, have certain character flaws that unfortunately contribute to how others define us, think of us, and relate to us, both good and bad. And this is at play even more than what we might realize or want to think. In fact, even when we are totally innocent, we're going to get blamed for things that would be in line with our reputations. We have to own the fact that our history follows us and that we have poisoned the well along the way. And therefore, when someone wrongly assumes something about us, well, those assumptions usually are not without some basis. It may not be true in this particular situation, whatever it might be, but it has been true in other situations. And this is one of the reasons that courts typically don't allow the jury to know of a defendant's prior convictions. It could cloud their objectivity for the jury. The defendant may have actually a long track record of breaking into people's homes, for instance. But in this particular case, he might actually be innocent. But for you and me, in our everyday lives, our past, our history with others, our track record, our reputations are entered into the evidence all the time. People's experiences with us and their observations all play a significant role in how they relate to us. And it works in the other direction as well, obviously. If we suspect that someone is wronging us in some fashion, we will issue our own verdict of guilt based on the person's track record, rather than fully consider all the facts and evidence before we make those conclusions. Right or wrong, it's just how things work. I do it to others, others do it to me, you do it to others, others do it to you. One's reputation is a very, very powerful thing. It really does condition the way that people relate to you. And once it is formed, it is very, very hard to change or undo. And whatever good you may have acquired in that reputation, it can, however, be shattered in an instant. Not surprisingly, there are some proverbs that speak to this. I have to turn it on. Bring it up. Okay, good. Proverbs 25, 9 through 10. If you argue your case with your neighbor, do not betray another man's confidence, or he who hears it may shame you, and you will never lose your bad reputation. To look at this from other versions, the ESV says, your ill repute will have no end. The New American Standard, the evil report about you will not pass away. The New Living Translation, you will never regain your good reputation. And the Christian Standard Bible, you'll never live it down. Now, the point of the proverb is clear enough. If someone tells you something that is to be kept secret, but at some point you divulge that secret because there is an advantage to do so, for instance, so as to bolster your case in some argument, well, the price for that will be quite high. You may end up convincing others of your point, but it will come at the cost of damaging your good name, your reputation. No one will trust you again. You don't want to be known as someone who will betray a confidence, someone who can't be trusted. You'll never live that down. Now, though this proverb in particular is addressing that of betraying a confidence, the warning here, of course, has a wider universal application. Protect your good name. Protect your reputation. It is probably the most valuable thing that you have. And once it is damaged, it can be quite hard to repair. The sentiment behind that is echoed in this one, another proverb, a popular one at the beginning of chapter 22. A good name is more desirable than silver and gold. And a similar one in Ecclesiastes, same point is made, a good name is better than fine perfume. Guard it carefully, don't ruin it. Likewise, whatever is part of your reputation that is undesirable, no expense should be spared, no sacrifice too great, no effort too unreasonable to fix it. A good name is worth more than all earthly treasures. It is worth investing in. Here's another one. Even a child is known by his actions, by whether his conduct is pure or right. 20 verse 11. A child's behavior reveals who he is, provides a pattern by which we can judge his character. It's all part of forming his reputation. It sets in place the way that we interact with that child. And so if that is true of children, how much more is that going to be true of adults? The one who lives a self-examined life will ask himself, how do others see me? What character flaws stand out to others? Have their experiences with me conditioned the way that they relate or interact with me? With each of us, there are positive traits that other people recognize and appreciate. And with each of us, there are also negative traits that other people recognize and have to work around or stay out of the way of. The one who strives to be conformed into Christ's image will take into account his flaws, will seek input from others who will be candid with him, will be concerned about his reputation, about how others see him, and will take steps, of course, to improve with God's help. Indeed, learning how others view us is a very effective way in coming to grips with our flaws, those things we are blind to. Well, it's safe to say, quite safe to say, that others are not blind to them. You may be, but others aren't. And think about that, if you would, the next time you pray for the Lord to show you areas in your life that need to be sanctified. Hopefully you're praying that. Typically, the answer isn't going to come in a vision or angelic visitation or dream or even in a so-called gentle whisper. Typically on this, when we ask the Lord to show us areas that need sanctified in our life, he speaks to us in an audible voice. He does. Like your boss and co-workers and family members and friends, neighbors, church members and spouse. He really does like to use the spouse. Former spouse, former boss, former friends, former pastor. People you are at odds with can tell you a lot about your flaws and blind spots. It's amazing who the Lord can use to tell us what needs work in our lives. And there are other ways to assess weaknesses and reputations, objective ways that all of us should be taking advantage of. One's credit score can be quite revealing. That can tell you a lot about yourself. It's an accurate report card, if you will, of your commitment to keep promises, of whether you are responsible, reliable, trustworthy, honorable, of whether you are willing to make sacrifices in order to meet your obligations. Do you think you put others first at the expense of yourself? Is that how you think of yourself? Well, does your credit score agree with that? Another one is your file at your place of employment. What do your annual reviews say about you? Your reprimands. Anything in that file that reveals actions or attitudes that are condemned in Scripture. How many traffic violations are on your record? What's behind all that? What do those violations say about how you think about yourself, how you think about others, what you think about authority? Do the rules apply to everyone but you? Is that the attitude that you harbor? The self-examined life will take all of these and more into account. The book of Proverbs refers to a number of different reputations that a person can be plagued with and gives all sorts of advice on how to deal with such people. But the advice, of course, really does cut both ways. It is outward and inward. And each one is an implied warning to not become such a person yourself. For instance, the proverb, you've heard it, like a bad tooth or a lame foot is reliance on the unfaithful in times of trouble. This is a neat proverb. It's not just a warning about those who are irresponsible, as in look out for those guys, you know, avoid them. It's also given to us as a means of self-reflection. This is the frustration that other people experience when you are unreliable. You are to them the pain of a bad toothache or broken foot. Now, I might wonder on a side note here that when Solomon wrote this, if he had not in his mind was wanting to speak of pain in another part of the human body to illustrate his point. But in the end, he chose to use tooth and foot instead. But either way, the point is made. Don't have a reputation of being unreliable. It's a pain to others and it will do you great damage. So, I carefully went through the book of Proverbs looking for various reputations, character flaws that people can be known by, and came up with a list that I'd like to read through. And there's actually quite a few. And as I read through them, see if any are ones that you are known by. Do any resemble comments or criticisms that you have heard through the years? We have the quick-tempered, the greedy, the flatterer, the proud, the lazy, the gossip, the glutton, the foolish, the nagging wife, the rebellious child, the unreliable, the angry, the stingy, the dishonest, the quarrelsome, the schemer, the gullible, the promise breaker, the perverse, the haughty, the mocker, the untrustworthy, the adulterer, the adulteress, the stiff-necked, the ignorant, the ruthless, the deceiver, the impulsive, the unfaithful, the devious, the drunkard, the rash, the sexually immoral, the sluggard, the moocher, the lover of pleasure. We have those who won't accept criticism, those who take advantage of the poor, those who are slack in their work, those who try to get rich quick, those who spread slander, who lack discretion, who talk too much, who chase after fantasies, who lack judgment, who scorn instruction, who delight in airing their own opinions, who dishonor their parents, who reject knowledge, who withhold good from others, who plot harm, who stir up dissension, who love to quarrel, who like to wield power over others. Anything on that list hit home? Maybe it's something not found in the book of Proverbs. Maybe it is something else. But everyone is known by their actions. Everyone is defined by a certain reputation. The question, of course, is how much attention are you giving this? How much effort are you making to undo it? I even left a few out of the list because I didn't think they applied here. Proverbs warn about those who are scoundrels. Got any scoundrels in here? You do? Okay. He pointed you. And the bloodthirsty and things like that. I thought, oh, surely there aren't anybody who's bloodthirsty here. But this now brings us to part two. Given that each of us has a track record of certain character flaws that others know us by, flaws that can be quite bothersome to others, let's now consider some helpful and practical ways to minimize the harm that such relationships can cause, especially that such reputations can cause, especially in our relationships. There's a whole nother sermon here. I'll let Sean do it of how to undo that reputation. But for our purposes this morning, I want to zero in on how to minimize the harm that our reputations do to others. And I have five of these. So are you ready for them? Yeah. All right. So like at our church, my sermons are like 15 minutes long, and halfway through, everybody wants a five-minute break. So is everybody okay? Do we need a break or anything? Need a break? Okay, we're over halfway. The first one. Can you, like, just nod to me that they're coming up okay? Good. Don't be so quick to take offense when others make wrong assumptions about you. Now, I've already talked about this, but it really is an important point to press. Typically, our first reaction when wrongly accused is something like, how dare they? Or they have no right. But the better reaction would be some self-examination, humility, some introspection. Given my track record, maybe I can't really blame them for thinking this. Or if people assume that I'm guilty of that, whatever it is, then I obviously have some work to do on how others see me. Now, granted, wrong accusations cannot be justified, but that's not the issue here. The issue is that we should use this as a mirror to look at ourselves. I am currently trying to restore a relationship where much of the problem deals with offensive things I did 20 to 25 years ago. And many of these I just simply can't even remember. And at this point, the person's not even willing to talk about it one-on-one, but they have written a couple letters bringing many of the offenses to my attention. And often in my responses, I've had to say things like, regarding this situation, whatever it might be, I honestly can't remember it. But given that I often treated you this way at other times, I'll accept your memory of it. I know that I wronged you often in this way. Please forgive me. We have to own the fact that from the bigger perspective, we do bear a certain guilt. We have, over time, polluted the well. If you choose the behavior, you choose the consequences. And one of the consequences of this kind of ongoing behavior is the forming of a certain reputation and all that goes with that. All of this then leads to the next one, number two. When falsely accused, the remedy has to be much more than proving your innocence. A better use of one's energy is that of repairing the reputation that contributed to the accusation. Someone reads into something you say more than what you intended. Someone suspects that you had an ulterior motive when you did this or that. Someone takes offense because you handled something in a way that they didn't like, and they're sure that you're trying to, you know, get at them in some way, and so on. These sorts of things are not uncommon. They happen to all of us. And certainly it's appropriate to get things cleared up and point out that in this case they got it wrong. But the real work that should occupy much more of our energy and concern is that of working on the reason people are quick to make such assumptions. Somehow we need to recondition them. And the way to do that is to, as Paul put it in to Romans, overcome evil with good. So pride compels us to prove our innocence, and we get fixated on that. Humility, however, compels us to look within. Humility compels us to extend grace to those who assume wrongly. Humility compels us to accept our own contribution to that wrong assumption. Humility compels us to use these situations for self-examination. Your reputation is worth investing in. If people think that you are obsessed with making money, or that you like to spread gossip, or that you flirt with others, or that you complain all the time, or that you seek attention, that you're condescending, contentious, that you're gruff with your wife, whatever it might be, even when you are not, then instead of getting all irate about that, work on repairing the image. This is similar, actually, quite similar to someone who gets really upset when others talk about them behind their backs, you know, sometimes referred to as gossip. Okay, maybe others shouldn't be talking about them behind their backs. But if you don't want people to talk about you, then don't give them something to talk about, right? That's where we look within. So that's what I'm trying really here to do this morning, is to exhort us to look inwardly. I have a family member who is irritated with me because they believe that I was too pushy with them on something. Well, on the example that they brought up, I wasn't being pushy at all. I really wasn't. They read way too much into something that I said. And again, I'm really innocent. Unfortunately, I had been quite pushy with this person in the past. And so in this, I was, quite frankly, reaping what I had sowed over the years. In the bigger picture, because I treasure that relationship, the task for me now is not that of convincing them of my innocence, proving them wrong, but, of course, of winning them over. And this is where the efforts need to be directed. Now, on a side note, they've been quite slow in responding to that, and so it's obvious what I need to do at this point. I must push them to see that I'm not as pushy as they think that I am. Everyone says, don't they amen in this church? All right, number three. Regarding one's record of wrongs, reputation, hope that people will forgive, but extend some grace here. Don't expect them to forget. Regarding the past offenses that you caused, well, it's pretty safe to say that forgiveness is almost always extended to those who are sincerely remorseful. But forgiveness is not the same as trust. Forgiveness purges their heart of resentment, but it does not necessarily purge their opinion. We need to let people to be a little leery of us. Trust has to be earned, and it takes time to earn it, and even more time to repair it when it is broken. You know, if you sold me a car and lied about how great it was and then later apologized, well, hopefully I would forgive you. I wouldn't harbor any resentment. I wouldn't feel angry or hurt or bitter if you apologized. We could make that right in that way. But I probably would not buy another car from you. That's not unforgiveness. We call that wisdom. Now, I might buy another car if I eventually become assured that you are trustworthy. In the same way, we need to let others whom we have wronged treat us with a certain degree of skepticism. It can take years to rebuild a good name, a good reputation, to earn that trust back. We need to be patient and charitable with those who are cautious. Reputations are kind of like credit scores. It takes a long time to move that number from the 600s to the 700s. And a really long time to move it into the 800s. Okay. Now I've lost where I'm at. Number four. Be charitable toward those who make wrong assumptions about you, and be charitable toward those you may be tempted to make assumptions about. And on this, as you see, we're approaching it from the other side of the table. Let us not do to others what we don't want them to do to us. You know, it's very easy to judge motives, to read into the words of others more than they intend, to dismiss their actions or comments because we are convinced something else is going on. We all do these sorts of things even when we don't realize it. It's one thing to be suspicious. It's another thing to form conclusions. And so we have to be careful. Don't accuse a man without cause. Proverbs 3:30. We ought to fight this tendency. When it comes to the motives and intentions of others, it is always better to give them the benefit of the doubt and assume the best, even when they don't do that for us. That's what we should do for them. So in light of that, check out this proverb, 19:11. A person's insight gives him patience, and his virtue is to overlook an offense. Wisdom, insight, wisdom yields patience. Patience with others. Wisdom, seeing things from God's point of view, enables us to cut others some slack. Wisdom from above, James says, is peace-loving, considerate, full of mercy. In fact, being charitable means taking the lowest and most humble attitude in all things. Expect others to hold your past against you, and in that, be charitable toward them when they make wrong assumptions or are slow to trust. But do not hold the past of others against them. Be charitable in giving them the benefit of the doubt and assume the best, not the worst. In other words, at all times, in all situations, make every effort to be at peace with all people. Romans 12. And now the last one, number five. Just as the worst evidence against you is a bad reputation, so also the best evidence for you is a good reputation. Let your history, your track record, speak for itself. Now, as a pastor, there have been a few times when people who have been a bit disgruntled have tried to stir things up behind my back, things that are not only false, but accusations that don't even come close to anything that I would ever do. And typically this comes from those who are relatively new to the church and they end up not liking something and, you know, away it goes. Now, in earlier years, I would have become unglued and thrown myself fully into a campaign to prove the accusations wrong and defend myself fervently. The record needs to be set straight. Everyone needs to know that I did not do that. In more recent years, I hardly give any response at all. I've been at that church in Fort Wayne now for almost 20 years. People who have been there for a while, well, they know full well what my sins are. They know the areas that I'm weak in. They know my failures. Some accusations they believe because they fit my profile, my MO, my reputation. And other accusations never get any traction at all because people dismiss them. I can't really see Wendell doing that. When people say things about us that are way off base, I would say that a good 90% of the time, if not more, we should just let it ride out. That which is false and that which is driven by maliciousness will run its course and die out on its own. Sometimes the more you fight it, the more you give the nonsense credence. Your best defense is your reputation, your track record, your history of behavior. It will speak for you. And so in these situations, we should show forbearance. Christ himself, of course, suffered false accusations, and in them we are told that he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. And so let us in that follow his example. Again, forbearance, forgiveness, humility, mercy. Paul says it well in Colossians. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with each other and forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. So in closing, let me offer these words. I find them to be quite profound. You're probably familiar with them. I did a little research, but couldn't exactly determine who came up with this first, but they go back to at least the early part of the 1800s. Sow a thought, reap an action. Sow an action, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. While we might think of destiny as something eternal, heaven or hell, which it is also true that there is a destiny in the present life as well. And one's reputation is certainly a part of that destiny. It is more valuable than silver and gold. It is worth investing in. That part of our reputation that is good, with God's help, let us strive to make it even better. And that which is not so good, with God's help, let's strive to reverse course, because we can turn it around. So I'll leave you with these words from 1 Thessalonians, and may they serve as kind of both a blessing and an exhortation. Paul writes to the church there, "May the name of our Lord Jesus be glorified in you, and you in him, according to the grace of our God and the Lord Jesus Christ." Amen.